You're listening to Muslimish Freethinkers, a podcast dedicated to fostering conversations on matters of faith and disbelief.
Welcome to Muslimish. If I find paper and pen in your cell, it's more dangerous than if I find a gun. That is what her jailer told her when she was jailed in September 1981. For the next 2 months of her imprisonment, Nawal Saadawi wrote Mudhakkarat fi Sijn al-Nisa in 1984. Memoirs from the Women's Prison, on a roll of toilet paper using a smuggled cosmetic pencil. Nawal Saadawi was born on October 27, 1931, and passed away last Sunday on the Eastern Mother's Day, March 21, 2021. She was an Egyptian secularist, feminist, humanitarian, author, activist, physician, and psychiatrist. She wrote many books on the subject of liberation of women, paying particular attention to the practice of female and male circumcision. She was against fundamental religions. She is considered to have been an apostate by many Muslims. She was described as the Simone de Beauvoir of the Arab world and as Egypt's most radical secularist feminist woman. Al-Saadawi was educated at Cairo University, Columbia University in New York, and Ain Shams University in Cairo, where she performed psychiatric research in 1972 to 1974. In 1955 to 1965, she worked as a physician at Cairo University and in the Egyptian Ministry of Health. And in 1966, she became the Director General of the Health Education Department within the ministry. In 1968, she founded Health Magazine, which was shut down by Egyptian authorities several years later. And in 1972, she was expelled from her professional position in the Ministry of Health because of her book, Al-Mar'a wal-Jins, 1969, Women and Sex, which was condemned by religious and political authorities. In 1982, Al-Saadawi founded the Arab Women's Solidarity Association and later served as an editor of the organization's publication, Al-Noon. In 1991, the government closed down Al-Noon, and then several months later, AWSA itself. Due to her outspoken views, Al-Saadawi continued to face frequent legal challenges from political and religious opponents, including accusations of apostasy. In 2002, a legal attempt was made by an Islamic lawyer to forcibly divorce her from her husband, and in May 2008, she won a case that had been brought against her by Al-Azhar University, the major center for Islamic learning, that included charges of apostasy and heresy. Al-Saadawi was not only an Egyptian feminist and human rights activist, she was an international feminist and human rights activist. She believed that both male and female children deserve protection from genital mutilation, circumcision. She was also critical about the objectification of women and female bodies in patriarchal social societies, neither by religious veil, religious headscarf, and religious clothes of women, nor selling by naked women. In 2002, lecture at the University of California, Saadawi described the U.S.-led war in Afghanistan as a war to exploit the oil in the region, and U.S. foreign policy and its support of Israel as real terrorism. Saadawi held the opinion that Egyptians are forced into poverty by U.S. aid. She believed that colonialism of Egypt was inherited by the United States from Britain. She was founder and president of the Arab Women's Solidarity Association and co-founder of the Arab Association for Human Rights. She was awarded honorary degrees on three continents, multiple honorary doctorates, and named one of the top women of the year in 1981 by Time, and again in 2015 by the BBC. In 2004, she won the North-South prize from the Council of Europe. In 2005, she won the Inanna International Prize in Belgium. And in 2012, the International Peace Bureau awarded her the 2012 Sean McBride Peace Prize. After traveling all over the world, I discovered that girls are brought up in a very similar way. We are all in the same boat. The patriarchal, religious, capitalist system is universal. I have had a dream since I was a child, a very mad dream, but very simple, to change the world. The dream is still alive. This is what Nawal Sadawi said in an interview in 2018. Muslimish strives to create a safe, supportive, and open-minded environment for the exchange of thoughts and ideas among Muslims with various degrees of religiosity, to foster a pluralistic society that respects the rights of all individuals to live according to their conscience, and to abolish blasphemy and apostasy laws across the globe. So it is natural for Muslimish to consider Nawal Sadawi as one of the heroes of freedom of speech. I would like to present to you the main speakers of today, who will each have a few minutes to present their commentary on Nawal Sadawi. Then we will open the discussion with a few more guests and with you through the comments. We encourage you to leave your comments in the comment section during the show. First, I will have the pleasure to introduce to you Dr. Jinan Raouf. She's a writer who uses oral history methodology in her work, a fine art photography activist, and a co-founder of a humanist organization, NAS, that focuses on fostering humanism in communities of Muslim background. She is a devoted mother of two boys. Welcome, Jinan, to this broadcast, and the floor is yours.
Thank you for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here with this wonderful panel. And to speak about someone as inspiring as Nawal Sadawi, I am going to be talking a little bit about how much Nawal Sadawi inspires me as a secular humanist who comes from a Muslim background. And I think for us as humanists, we're here on Earth for a very short period of time. And so one of the values that informs our lives as humanists is that we are here to experience life intensely and to enjoy it and to learn and to develop our potential. So when I think about the complexity of a character like Nawal Sadawi, who identifies herself first as a human being and as a woman and as a writer and a dissident and a rebel and an organizer and a socialist and a physician and a psychiatrist, and as somebody who was exiled from her country but went back and took part in the revolution, this is someone who is an incredibly interesting role model for me, because this is a woman who lived her life intensely and developed her faculties and her potential. So for a humanist, you can't box her in. You can't say she's one thing or the other. And as tragic as all the discussions that are going on about in the wider society, like, is she an apostate? Is she a Muslim? Is she going to hell? Is she that? That really misses the point and the complexity of a character like Nawal Sadawi, because it's really hard to pin her down. She's a dynamic woman who's constantly changing and growing. And I think that that really frustrates people. And it brings out a lot of the insecurities that people have of wanting to know, well, what was she? Was she a Muslim? Was she an apostate? And so forth. And I think that's what makes her, from my perspective as a humanist, such an interesting and inspiring character, is that there is this fluidity and there is this ability to see what can be done with life. And so in that, that's one way that I think we can approach her work. So I would like to just touch a little bit upon her work to demonstrate that. So she was, so this complexity of her character, I think also is reflected in the very wide range of writing styles that she incorporates. I mean, this is a woman who writes, you know, straight books about Al-Mar'a wal-Jins, you know, the theoretical books, but she also writes plays, she writes autobiographies, she writes memoirs, she writes prison memoirs. And I think it is that it is really, I think we need to be very attentive to how her very complex the complex dimensions of her being are given expression in different mediums. And I think she was experimenting a lot with different kinds of writing because she had a very irrepressible urge to express herself. And so that is, I think, is something that one can look at as one is looking at the different kinds of writings that she does. But for me also, as a secular humanist, I am very intrigued by her representation of her grandmother. Because her grandmother, she takes pains. And I don't know if this is like a literal, realistic representation of her mother, or whether it is a trope, whether she's creating for herself an ancestor, a female ancestor through whom she can think back. You know, we have feminist writers like Virginia Woolf who said we need to think back through the grandmothers. So it's very interesting, the representation of the grandmother in her work. And in so many of her interviews, she goes to great lengths and pain to say, my grandmother was a peasant. She was an illiterate woman. She did not have much education, but she was a rebel. And she was a revolutionary. And she would take on the religious figures in the village. And for her, God was all about justice. And so I think she becomes, for her, this ancestor who is female, who is rebellious, in a society where we assume that women, particularly women from who are not literate, or women who live, you know, who come from traditional families and who live in the village, we assume that they are going to be passive. And we also assume that they are going to be, and this is really important, that they are going to be passive consumers of knowledge that's constructed by male structures. And then the women are going to imbibe that automatically. So I think it's a very clever move, because what she's saying is, you don't have to go to Oxford, you don't have to be a westernized elite to have this innate human sense of justice and of not submitting to male authority. Now, for me as a humanist who does not believe in the divine origin of knowledge, that's a big deal. It means that we're seeing women who are constructing and creating knowledge from their lived experiences. And if we go on and we look a little bit more, when she's asked very often in interviews, so are you like your grandmother? Are you a rebel by nature? Are you a rebel? She says specifically, it's partly genetic and it's partly acquired. In other words, what she's really saying is this idea that women are obedient, or that this is part of our, in Islamic terms, our fitra, or our nature, to be passive and to be obedient, whether we're talking about obedience to a father figure in the home, to a male teacher in the school, to a prophet maybe, or to a god, that this is, all of this is being called into question. And she is affirming that, and she's locating it within her family tree going back, but also in a specific locale. So here she's making another, in my view, really interesting move, is that this is a non-Western form of feminism. This is not the feminism that we are passively importing from the West. And she says something that's really interesting. She says, you know, we practice feminism before we have a word for it. And that's a really interesting thing, because the West seems to think that they have to label things in order for things to be recognizable, and therefore we can see it. So she goes on and she talks about her own development as a writer. And one of the things that she emphasizes, I think, a lot, is that it is from her experiences as a child that she begins to awaken to the fact that she is a feminist. So, and I so identify with that. So the locus of where she actually begins to have a sense that she's a girl is in the home in relationship to her brother. So she has a brother who's a year older than her, who's spoiled, who doesn't do any work. who doesn't study, who's not doing as well as she is doing academically, and yet he's rewarded. Whereas she is very successful academically. She helps her mother around the house. And then she notices that he gets rewarded because he's a male by having freedom. So she sees freedom as a reward. And so her reaction to that situation is she learns about injustice at home. She uses a child's language. It's unfair. And so again, as a humanist for me, the idea that you have to have a revealed religion in order to know right from wrong, or in order to know what justice is, no, this is innate. This child learns from her lived experience. And that gives her the courage. And her writing, by the way, is very, very personal. And so she fights back. And then the other incident that she talks about is when she is at school and the teacher asks her to write her name. So she writes her name. She writes Nawal Zainab Saadawi. And the teacher looks at her and she says, no, no, no. Cross out Zainab because that's her mother's name and write your father and your grandfather's name. And she says this is a moment when she's like an epiphany for her. And I find that very interesting. And she says, there's two reasons why I wanted to have my mother's name. A, my mother gave birth to me. And B, my mother was the one who taught me the alphabet. She was the one who taught me. And that's a very interesting move as well, because what she is insisting upon here is that a woman is both a biological being, but that she's also a cognitive intellectual being. Now, we know in Western tradition, culture is often associated with the male and nature is with the female. Nawal Saadawi is really appropriating that and saying that the logos or the word or language or the transmission of knowledge can go through the woman. And it is her mother who teaches her how to right. So that's a really important thing. And so I think by implication, what she is challenging in the school is that the official educational institutions are not going to erase the knowledge that comes from the home and is not going to erase her personal experience. It's just kind of, she's giving it a name. She's giving kind of worth to the mother, but also to the kind of experiences that she will eventually have as a writer who's writing about her own experience. She's kind of giving it a kind of legitimacy. Maybe what I'm driving is that she's creating a kind of literary genealogy for herself, which I find really, really interesting. And then it's very interesting. Then the third thing is, she then begins to question. So we go from the, I refuse to be erased, to rebelling and questioning. And when she asks her parents, why can't I go out? The question that she gets is, because God said so, because God lets boys go out. And she began to realize that God interferes in everything. And this is really interesting. So she says she writes a letter to God. So again, as you see, her writing is always comes out organically from a particular cultural context that she is in. And she is angry at God. She's angry at God. Now, for people who are fundamentalists, this can seem like apostasy. But we have Job in the Old Testament. You know, this there is this tradition of writing where you are debating with God. And so what I would argue here is that you have indigenous traditions. I mean, I think in 1 year after Bertrand Russell wrote Why I'm Not a Christian, there was an Egyptian writer who, I don't remember his name right now, he wrote Why I'm an Atheist and was not killed and was not so forth. So for me as a humanist, so here is someone who is struggling. And for her, she is talking with God and she's saying, if you are going to be unfair to me, if you are going to be cruel to me, by giving my brother, who's far less talented, freedoms that I don't have, then I will not worship you. So this idea then of questioning becomes an integral part of her work and her life, both as an intellectual and I would argue as an activist, that she is going to, so we go from, you know, establishing this kind of genealogy of women literary predecessors, I think, to critical thinking. And for me, again, as somebody who's a humanist, critical thinking is of the essence. And what she's doing meanwhile is, I think she's cultivating virtues that appeal to us as humanists, because it's so, one of the virtues that she's cultivating here is courage, is the courage to speak back, to talk back, to insist that her experiences are valid and not to submit. So she is de facto undoing a lot of the virtues that have traditionally or historically been associated with traditional gender roles and that are often pushed upon women who are pious. So she is elevating virtues such as rebellion and anger. And this is where I find she really anticipates a lot of what's happening now in the feminist world. We've had a series of books now about the importance that of anger for women, that we have to be angry. So this anger that she felt towards her brother, towards the boys who would harass her on the street because she dared go out on the street and they were trying to put her in her place. But this anger is now being reclaimed by feminists, for example, like the firebrand feminist, Mona Tahawi, who's saying, we have to reclaim that anger because that anger is what allows us to say no. What gives us courage and what enables us in the as we organize to change the world that is enraging us. So I think in many ways she was both an intersectional feminist and somebody who recognized the incredible importance of anger that we suppress in women in ways that are used, I think, to make us more submissive. And she understood that before it was really, I think, as widely as understood as it is now. And I was just reading a really interesting article by a young feminist, maybe she looked like she was in her 20s in Egypt, who was so angry about the spate of sexual harassment and rapes that are now going on in the country. And she said, I never knew it until I watched an interview with Noëlla Sadawi, and she talked about the importance of anger. And I understood. And so I think her influence is not only in what she says or her ideas, but how she liberates women emotionally in the body to express and to feel that rage and that anger. And I think that's a really important thing. And it, because she's a very holistic writer, her emotions are not split off from her intellect. And then she goes on and she says, as I graduated, as I went to college, I began to realize that my anger, I had to do something with it. And she wanted to change the world because it's not enough. And that's where I think in the West, people often, she's often represented, and the receptive space in this in the West is that she is this iconic feminist who's just so extraordinary and so different. But she talks a lot about the importance of organizing and of solidarity with other women and men in order to change structures. And I think that that's another one of her really important roles, and that is in a, and she's very, very clear about the fact that she does not want to be confused with a white liberal feminist where it's all about careerism and the individual becoming successful. She's talking about human solidarity and the capacity for people to work together in order to change structures. And I think that in this historical moment that we are in, she is extremely relevant for people who come from communities of color like us, who are in a situation in the US where we are fighting for religious freedom or freedom from religion, but we are also engaged at the same time in struggles against injustice, whether we're talking about imperialism or racism or white supremacy or economic suppression, because she was a socialist. And so in the West, they always like to talk about Noëlla Sadawi or predominantly as somebody who fought female genital mutilation, which she did, and which is extremely important. But what I am saying is that it's important that we don't just reduce her to that, because the breadth of her commitment is really, really much larger. And I think I'll stop, because I could go on, because I really admire her. So I think I will. I'll stop.
Yeah, no, thank you, Jinan. I mean, I wouldn't have stopped you, because it was a beautiful flow of narrative about al-Sa'dawi, and this, you ended it with a very important point that many try to reduce her to the person who fought female genital mutilation, but she is way larger than that. And if she was given more platform, she would have even tackled more subjects. But we're very glad that she has focused on this important subject. Thank you, Jinan. We'll come back to you with the dialogue section. I'd like to introduce you now to our next speaker, Barbara Nimri Aziz. She's a New York-based anthropologist, journalist, and author. As a founder and director of RAWI, Radius of Arab American Writers Incorporation, up to 2005. She promoted literary community in its early stages. This was related to her radio journalism as producer and host of www.radiotahrir.org from 1989 to 2013. Nawal al-Sa'dawi was among the outstanding and emerging literary and political personalities who appeared on her program. You can learn more about Aziz's work, Barbara's work, including her books and blog, at barbaranimri.com. And congratulations, Barbara, on your new recent publication. The floor is yours. Just unmute yourself.
Mute. Okay. Again, thanks very much, Wasim, and thank you to Muslimish for inviting me today to join this. I feel a bit of an interloper here, because after Jinan's eloquent analyses, from which I myself began to reflect more about Nawal al-Sa'dawi, I haven't read her work for many years. What I can contribute is more anecdotal, because I met Nawal al-Sa'dawi on many occasions going back to 1990. And you mentioned RAWI, the Arab American Writers Organization. Through that, I pursued Arab writers, whether they were in the United States or in the Arab lands. And she was one of those people I was keen to meet and to draw into RAWI, but also to interview, because I began my my dialogue, I guess you could call it, with Nawal al-Sa'dawi through my interviews on WBAI, on Radio Tahrir. And I just want to add a few anecdotes. I remember her saying how important her medical work was. You mentioned in the introduction her work in the ministries. But before that, of course, she was a physician. And I remember her saying to me how she moved through the villages and there learned a great deal about conditions, especially of women, which helped her formulate some of her early feminist thinking. Jinan just talked about how her own family and her relations with her brother and her parents also provided the kind of seed of feminism. And then later on, then she had the practical experience with other women, and through medicine also understood their lives much better. Also, I want to mention that I knew both Nawal and her husband, Sharif Hatata, who was a novelist. And he was, I remember, an employee or an official with the ILO, the International Labor Organization. And he was very much a Marxist. and a political theorist. And Nawal, I remember saying how it was through his influence on her as a Marxist that expanded her perspective again, and her pursuit in understanding more clearly capitalism and patriarchy. And they work very, very well as a team in that respect. And in a way, she brought his teaching, his political teaching, to a much more advanced level. By advanced, I mean through her writing and her speaking. His speaking, when I heard him on a couple of occasions, was much quieter. And he was just a very different character. And his writing was perhaps more penetrating, but in her speaking, she was able, as all of you know, to fuse her understanding of capitalism and patriarchy and international colonialism, of course, in a very, very rich way. He also was her translator on many of her, especially her early books. His English was very, very fluent. Of course, hers is as well. But as Janan, I think, mentioned, Nawal preferred to write in Arabic. I want to also recall an incident early on, which I remembered just yesterday when I was going through some of my materials about her. I remember the occasion where, you know, when Nawal came to New York, she was very much a celebrity for a very small group of people in the 90s. It was not a large group. She was quite unpopular with a certain Arabic middle-class community who were very embarrassed about circumcision issues being made so public. And also, they didn't understand her either. They probably hadn't read her work, but she was very flamboyant, you could say almost flamboyant. Certainly very articulate and very bold. Maybe bold is better than flamboyant. So there was a lot of criticism of her. You know, we as Arabs here needed a hero or a heroine. We needed an international figure, and she was not easily digested by many of the established Arab community here. In any case, I was asked, and I was thrilled, to accompany her on an NPR interview. That was a radio interview. She was visiting New York, so I went with her to the NPR studio and sat throughout that. But the opening question of this very well-known, although I don't recall her name, may have been Cokie Roberts, or, you know, a leading NPR host, started the interview by asking Nawal. It sounds quite incredible today when you hear this, but she said to Nawal, the opening statement, can you imagine? Are you a good Muslim? And Nawal was just, her reply was brilliant. I mean, she didn't faze her at all. And her reply was, that is between God and me. And to me, and I think to many others, that is symptomatic. That is a real Nawal reply, because she had to deal, as she emerged as a spokesperson of Islam, in a way, you know, we're going back to the 90s, and very little was written, generally very little was written that was before this famous what's her name, Anderson, who writes about Islam. All these Western writers who began interpreting Islam in the late 90s in the early 90s, there was very little one could go to that was simplistic enough. And so Nawal became a kind of target, in a way, of people questioning Islam. And I think that question that was put to her in that interview is an example of that. And she could handle these naiveties beautifully, really. And then, of course, the Muslim woman, but the Arab woman also was something, if not exotic, at least something not very positive. Again, we're talking about the early 90s when we didn't have so many celebrities and we didn't have the films, the acknowledgement of our achievements and our lives. We didn't have so many novels and other writings by Arab women in English, and very few translated. So again, she became, in a way, the spokesperson for our culture, our religion, our woman identity. And she handled that very well. And I'm sure over the years, she grew more and more better equipped to handle the very naive public. And then you find her very exciting talks. I mean, now you're seeing, after her passing, you're seeing clips from interviews, and you see how sharp she is. And as Janann Rauf was just saying, you know, she was very, she was able to combine and fuse and enrich issues in a way that very few people can. Very few people can. And you notice in her interviews, no bitterness at all. Very kind to a lot of very rude people. And, you know, I was sorry at the time that so many of our established Muslim community, Arab community here, again, I'm talking about another generation. I'm not talking about young feminists. By young, I mean people under 40. And, you know, they were not ready for her. They couldn't handle her, and they were not receptive to her. And so I myself felt badly that we couldn't entertain her, and not just entertain her, but to host her in the forums, that she couldn't become a focus of our own need as an ethnic community, as a religious community. And so she was drawn more to white feminists. Let me just use that term generally, let's say American white feminists, who did understand her, who were not laden with this Arabness and our own confusion about our own identity. And we, you know, being put on the spot to answer questions about our religion and our fathers and our brothers and, you know, our heritage, which was confusing for many of us. And she was very clear. And particularly, just to sum up, I'm an anthropologist, and I had not a lot of feminist thinking and orientation as an anthropologist. Again, I finished my PhD in 1974, and the 70s were just the beginning of Western feminism and how Western feminism came to impact sociologists and anthropologists, all disciplines, of course. But I was less influenced by the writing of other early scholars criticizing anthropology. And when I met Nawal al-Sadawi, I understood her in a way, her ability to analyze feminism and patriarchy. And to this day, I still am very upset how Western feminists, in fact, became patriarchal towards us, towards the global women. They assumed the role, even though they were feeling liberated, Western feminists assumed this patriarchal role and saw the rest of us as victims who they needed to liberate, who they needed to study. And Nawal would have none of that. And watching her, reading her work, I was able myself to understand this trap that those of us of the other world can become stuck in. And in that respect, she was very, very important. I mean, the way she links white feminism or Western feminism with patriarchy is very profound and very simple.
She's
a very simple thinker in so many ways. I'll finish there.
Thank you, Barbara, very much for this insightful take, and also about giving your testimony to history about your personal encounter with Nawal Saadawi in the early 80s and 90s. The next speaker I'd like to introduce to you is Zainab Asaf from University of Wayne State. She's a local here in Detroit. I'm going to read the bio in Arabic. Zainab Asaf, شاعرة وكاتبة لبنانية تعيش في أمريكا. أستاذة في قسم اللغة الفرنسية في جامعة وين ستيت. صدر لها في الشعر صلاة الغائب، بواب الذاكرة الفض، فراشة ميتة بعد إطباق كتاب عليها، في النثر غيابك الصامت والعميق كمياه خطرة، وفي الترجمة عن الفرنسية إقليديسيات لأوجين جيوفيك، وفي الرواية تصدر قريبا عودة إيما. شاركت في تأسيس وتحرير مجلة نقد وجريدة ودار الغاوون للشعر، عملت كمديرة للقسم الثقافي في جريدة أوان، ومحررة ثقافية في جريدة النهار اللبنانية. Welcome Zainab. Barbara. Zainab, she got disconnected for a second. We'll come back to her once she's back. We have with us also Wafa. Wafa Bahri. Oh, Zainab is back. We'll come back to Wafa. Zainab, are you with us? Great. Good to see you. Your sound and picture.
Yes, can you hear me? I'm really
but I can hear you. Can you hear me?
I don't. Oh, yeah. I'm sorry for this because I'm
no problem.
On my it's phone cutting. And I have some. Okay. So I just wanted to. I don't know what to say after what Dr. Nimri Aziz and Dr. Rolf said. I think they covered all the aspects of. And gave her, a complete ability. But what I wanted to say is maybe I can import something from another perspective, which is like a following generation. So I wanted to relate to this point, which is like Nawal Saadawi is not an Occidental feminist, not because she is like this genuine feminist, Arabic feminist, but because she's coming from a generation of feminism in the Arabic world, because feminism didn't really start in the Occidental world. Because if we go a little bit to history and see, for example, that the Syrian Hind Nawfal, who was born in 1860, published a feminist magazine in 1892. And that means even before Virginia Woolf's book, A Room of One's Own. So, I mean, we're talking about like almost around the same time, like the Arabic feminism started the same time when Occidental feminism started. And I guess this is the situation in the whole world for a reason, because around this time, women started going to school. So, I mean, this idea that white Occidental women invented feminism, it's not very true. It's only the matter of languages, like maybe because there's no enough translation of these early Arabic feminist work, I wanted to mention a few works here. Like, for example, of course, we cannot talk about feminism and not mention Huda Sha'rawi, who was born in 1879 in Cairo and who fought for women's rights for education in Egypt. We cannot also, so like these two names, I took these two names, which were the early Arab feminists. And also, so this is, one of them is in Syria, the other one is in Egypt. Also in Lebanon, like we cannot forget other names. For example, Labiba Hashim, who published The Girl of Orient in 1906, the beginning of the 20th century. Afifa Karam, who became, she immigrated to New York, but she continued her activism. Also, we cannot not talk about May Ziyadi, for example, or like Salma Abi Rashid, who was the first lawyer, female lawyer in Lebanon. So what I wanted to say is like Arabic feminism really started around the same time when Occidental, I don't like this word, but this is, I don't find a better one. So when Occidental feminism started, so it's not something that we imported because we want to destroy religion or, you know, like this patriarchal system that we have. It's something that just happened naturally everywhere in the world. But it, of course, it's very normal too that the narrative we have is the Occidental narrative, because until now it's the English language, it's the whole, I wanted to say the industry of knowledge is completely in the Occident still, but it doesn't mean that feminism didn't exist in the Arabic world before Nawal al-Sa'dawi. And it will continue, of course, after Nawal al-Sa'dawi. Now, Nawal al-Sa'dawi was very, very important for one reason, which is like combining feminism with political activism. And in this meaning, I found her a little bit close to the Anglo-American meaning of feminism more than the French feminism, for example, because we know like French feminists were very much, they worked so much on a theoretical level, like kind of like having discussion with Marxism, with constructuralism and all the other thinking schools. So Nawal al-Sa'dawi was kind of both of them. She had the theoretical, I wanted to say part, and especially I think Dr. Rolf talked about, I think Dr. Aziz said that it's also because of her husband too, like the influence of her husband. But she kind of had both of them. She had like the political activism and the theoretical knowledge as a feminist, and that makes her a real icon, like someone who's very she had it all, if we can say that. So. And I think that's why like she is still a figure which is a very not necessarily that everyone will accept her. And I think she knew her all her life and she acted based on this. She wouldn't even be surprised now that the level of discussion happening in the Arabic world is so mediocre to the point that people are saying, is she going to heaven or to hell? Like, I cannot really imagine that we really having this discussion now. But I mean, she was completely a real person, and she knew that the influence that she would have, because like, for example, someone like me, how like the books of Nawal al-Sa'dawi were for me and for my generation and for a lot of other girls too, these are like the founding books to see the world in a different way. Now, for me, it was a little different because I grew up in a house where we have a freedom, where we were very used to discuss. But I imagine for someone who never had another point of view, how important all these books are, like to give a woman a tongue to talk in her native language and then to discuss things that we take for just, we accept them the way they are. So this is very, very interesting. The other point I wanted to talk about is feminism and literature, and why Nawal Al-Saadawi decided to write. Like, she could just be a doctor. She's a physician, and she was practicing, and then someone would say, like, she would just continue practicing, help women this way. So why did she write? And I think it's very organic for any feminist to write, because we shouldn't forget that feminism, unlike other disciplines, is a tightly literary related theory. And the reason is because women, when they started getting educated, that was their tools. This is how they started this discussion with the society, through literature. And then feminism is always very concerned about how women were absent from literature for centuries and centuries. So it's very natural, it's very normal that she went for writing. And then I wanted to talk about another thing, which is like, which is very interesting. And I think Nawal also had this in her personality. She always talked about human liberation, not only women liberation. So that means in some ways, like she talks a lot about the imperialism and other things. So she was struggling in two barrels, if I can say that. Like, first, she is with this society, struggling inside this society against all kind of injustice, I will say common injustice, as a group of Arab people. And the second fight was for Arab women, which is like inside this society. And this is very interesting because it reminds me also of African-American feminists. I think Teresa Guy talks about this in her book. It's kind of like letters between her and Maya Angelou. And she mentioned how during the civil rights movement, she said literally, so we as African-American women, we found ourselves struggling for the African-American man. And then after that, we have to go to another struggle, which is for the American women. So I think like it really speaks to the kind of situation Nawal lived all her life, and the kind of courage she endured in her life, and even after her death, when we see that the kind of conversation happening now in the Arabic world. But anyhow, I feel like not even in the Arabic world, even here among our community, we're all aware of this. What I wanted to say, it's all of this is really healthy. Nawal will continue to be an icon and to inspire a lot of new coming generation. She is very authentic to the Arabic and the Islamic culture. And I think if we don't get to the point in our Arabic world to accept someone like Nawal and to acknowledge her and to respect her and to love her, because she really spoke in behalf of those who couldn't talk, you know. So, I mean, if we don't get to this point, I don't think we can really have any hope, you know. Like, we have to get inside our Islamic and our Arabic culture to accept this level of discussion. Otherwise, I don't know where we are going, because the kind of discussions we're having now reminds me, like, you know, like even during the 7th century, people were really much more advanced in their level of discussion about narrative, about native Arabic sciences, which is everything related to Quran and to the Arabic language. So this is very, very interesting, like this point, which is like whenever someone, it's the same point also when we talk about the Arabic Spring, which is like these people who have this Occidental mentality, and now they want to destroy the society. And this is what extremists keep repeating and repeating and repeating. Like if we, like whenever we're always copying, and this is really not very true.
I'm sorry, continue, Zeynep, please.
So I was saying, like whenever it comes to talk about freedom, to talk about women's rights, to talk about human rights in general, we have always this sensitivity, which is like, yes, but this is an Occidental approach to this topic. And I think this is definitely not true, especially in the case of Nawal al-Saadawi and Arabic feminism. Now, when I say Arabic feminism, also, I want to mention that we had a lot of men Arab feminists, like, for example, Qasem Amin, who is a pioneer in this domain. And he was born in 1863. So if we compare, so actually, the 60s is kind of the high water for feminism around the world, including the Arab world. And this is also the time when Nawal was very active. So it was kind of like a general activity all around the world. It wasn't something that, like, it wasn't that we decided to be influenced by Occident So basically, this is what I wanted to talk about. I don't know if you want me to continue.
Thank you very much, Zeynep. We actually, yeah, I know that. I'm glad that we heard you. I'm gonna remove you for a second, just to clarify the sound. I'm glad, Zeynep, we heard you very clearly. So, because it was a very, very important insight and interjection. I really feel that these need to be individual lectures. They're very, very important takes and points. And speaking of which, on the level of conversations, we actually have Amer Zahar with us, who we're going to discuss some of his engagement with the community about this in a second. But before we bring Amer and Wafa, she's been waiting with us. And thank you, Wafa, for joining us. Wafa, she's a Tunisian, Mazir, free thinker and advocate for individual liberties. Thank you, Wafa, for joining us. Please do participate. We want to hear you.
Thank you so much for having me. And it's really an honor for me to participate in this discussion about an icon, and that's Dr. Nawal al-Saadawi. I'd like to add a layer in my introduction, which you did very well, Wissam. Thank you very much. And that's I am an ex-Muslim. So I identify myself as a Tamazight ex-Muslim woman originally from Tunisia. And what I would like to talk about after the fantastic talks by the three first speakers, who provided a very deep and complex interpretations to Dr. Saadawi's work, what I'm going to do is probably a more of a superficial and straightforward reading of Nawal Saadawi's work. And I think that what unites Dr. Saadawi's work is her feminism, because for her, feminism includes everything, the social justice, the political justice, the sexual justice, and it becomes really hard to start a conversation or discussion about the oppression of women without having that background already set up and without having the framework, and that's feminism. So in Nawal Saadawi's work or a discourse about feminism, she fought, as we all know and been mentioned, against female circumcision. And I think her book, which I read a long time ago, Woman and Sex, is where she laid out her opinion bluntly and bravely against this horrendous practice. also her fight against the idea of a woman's virginity as a guardian of virtue and honor for men, and particularly during the wedding night, and the amount of humiliation and degradation that comes along this idea, and not only for men, not only for women, but also for men. And this is another area of strength in Noelle's work. Her feminist discourse does not only is very inclusive for both men and women, and men in her discourse are not simply allies, are not enemies, but also are not just allies for the feminist discourse. They matter as much as women matter, and they could be seemingly victimized by the patriarchy. Then her fight against the child bride practice, which is a cultural practice, but also it's reinforced by the religious and teaching, and particularly in the Arabic-speaking world or the Muslim-majority countries, it's reinforced by Islam. And we all know the story of Aisha, the youngest wife of Muhammad, and how that affected the narratives afterwards. Noelle's blame is all that, obviously, on poverty, probably the question of class and capitalism and the religious fundamentalism, obviously. But one of the battles that clung to my mind, and I find it really interesting, and I think Gina spoke about it already, and that's women giving their names to their children. I found the struggle that or the battle that her daughter went through, and the ordeal that her daughter Muna Noelle Hilmi went through because of this title, Muna Noelle Hilmi. I think she signed a letter on the mother's day, mom Noelle, and using her name Noelle, and she ended up being in court because of this. Because of doing so. So she was taken to court for doing this. But this incident was considered a kind of hearsay or of a hearsay nature, and probably formed the base of several accusations of blasphemy and apostasy against Noelle As-Sadawi. Another battle where she I am personally influenced by, and I found inspiration, and that's the question of hijab, in the Muslim majority countries, and particularly the idea of hijab as a choice, which is another narrative that Noelle Sadawi criticized vehemently. She's probably among the pioneers, as I understand her work, who understood the effects of the indirect oppression that comes along wearing hijab. So women, they may hear them talking about hijab as a free choice, but they forget one aspect, and that's very important, and that's the fact that these women are indoctrinated since birth, since childhood, into the notion of religious modesty or the modest culture. So, and the result in our societies, in our communities and conversation, is that we find all these women, and I don't want to overgeneralize, but we all came across women who are Muslims or who are wearing their hijab, and who would ask us, for instance, when are you going to wear your hijab? Or who would come up very critical if we remove hijab or if we refuse to wear it. Where all this is coming from? Well, it's coming from the indoctrination, the indirect indoctrination into these notions of modesty and legitimacy of the men to control and police women's bodies, using the religious teaching, of course, and along with the political hegemonic ideologies. And I think this is where Noelle As-Sadawi comes up as a true leader and a true leader of a change and enlightenment. In a more explicit discourse, in more explicit narratives, Noel declares that religions in general are the main ordeal and the source of oppression for women, and that's inevitable and undeniable. And I think here where Noel Sahrawi becomes the dangerous writer and thinker, as she likes to call herself, and as many of her followers and fans like to call her. And actually, this is the most part that influenced me most personally, and that the willing to take the risk in talking about women's oppression. So this is an area where her radical feminism comes into full shape, in my opinion, and where her radical feminism is well catalyzed. I mean, we know that the backlash against feminism is everywhere in the world, and that's not limited to the Muslim majority countries or Arab countries, and that the load of patriarchy sits on the shoulders almost of every single woman and every society. But we cannot deny, and this is what I found her really a dangerous thinker and writer and pretty straightforward and honest, we cannot deny that this is boosted up, is reaffirmed, and it's enabled by religions, and particularly by Islam in Muslim majority countries. So and Noel's views that the sexist, misogynist, cultural practices against women are undeniably reinforced by religions. And I mean, even though we don't want to reduce her to the discourse around or the narratives around FGM, but because this is unfortunately an ongoing practice in many countries around the world, I think her contribution here remains relevant all the time and remains worth mentioning and revisiting again and again. Why is that? I mean, based on my understanding, because I mean, the discourse or the narrative of FGM comes in almost every single fundamentalist speech or discourse, every single speech or discourse of all these religious clergy and figures and religious zealots. So these types of struggles and battles and Noel's advocacy to the feminist social justice defines again what's called radical feminism in her work. Her opposition to the political and the social institutions, agenda, and ideologies in Egypt or in the rest of the Arabic-speaking and nations in general is where women are not accustomed to the habit of not having a voice or forming an opinion, but they're even deprived it of like raising that voice and or speaking openly about the opinions they form. And challenging the cultural and religious and norms, I think Noel Sahrawi, through all these battles, she undermines patriarchy and whatever comes along patriarchy, the hierarchical structure, such as class, which is an area that she tackled so deeply. And she wrote about it in many of her articles and writings and plays. I have not read much of Noel Sahrawi, even though I'm so inspired by her writing and her style, and of course her radical feminist, particularly the notion of radical feminism and how she understands that. I mean, I remember in one of her interviews when she was asked what does she mean by or why does she want to be identified as a radical feminist, and she said, well, there are different types of feminists, which is true. There are different types of feminist discourses around the world, but in Arabic speaking world, in the Arabic speaking nations, I mean, we need to fight for all these feminism, all these forms of feminism, because they're all there is a lack of all these types of feminism. So like I said, I haven't read all of her books, but I read so much of her articles, and I read one of the books that claimed to me and spoke to me personally as a nascent, if I may introduce myself, a nascent Tunisian feminist, is her Woman at Point Zero, where I think Nawal Sadawi provided a clear and pretty neat approach on how she understands patriarchy as an expression of socioeconomic oppression, and where she insisted that the status of women should be accompanied by the defeat of capitalism alongside, I mean, patriarchy, if we really have a good intention, if we really have an honest intention to improve and establish to improve the women's status and establish an equal system. So the character in the book, in A Woman at Point Zero, her name was Firdaus. I mean, the way it was introduced in the book, from what I remember, is that she met the author in a prison, on where the author gave her floor to share her narratives, to voice out her story without interruption. And that's very important, not interrupting women when they are voicing out. Because women don't do this and don't get these chances all the time. Firdaus was married to, first of all, she underran, like many women, she went through FGM practice. That's what first oppression she faced. But then she was forced into this marriage with an older man than her, who treated her very poorly, very badly. And then she had to run away and jump into the world of prostitution, selling her body. But what I found very interesting about this character is that she was presented as a woman who had great ability in manipulating the forces which are more powerful than her, and that's by taking prostitution as a tool of or an instrument of a liberation, of a freedom. So Firdaus, the main character of this book, she insisted on a high price for her body. She rejected men who were dirty, and above all, she resisted by making her body passive during the sexual intercourse. And that makes me question all the time, what are the different methods that women in North Africa or in the Middle East, or women even in those in whatever society and where they find themselves oppressed, what are the different methods and how could we legitimize those methods if they turn into tools or instruments of liberation? I mean, here the resistance in a sexual intercourse, but I mean, I'm thinking about the use of drama. I mean, always there's this stereotype that women always use drama, but I mean, yeah, why not? If that's a method, if that's a tool, it's gonna lead me to win over the patriarchal dominance, so why not? And this point specifically, I mean, speaks to me, and my resistance coming from the same, of course, the same society as Nawal Sa'rawi. I mean, it's not too much different. This is what I find really interesting. And another scene, if I remember, is the scene of a food where Firdaus.
Wafa. I'm sorry.
I want to interrupt.
I am waiting to find myself at a good point to interrupt you, and I can't find it.
Okay, no problem.
So, but we have 15 minutes left in the program, and I thank you very much. As I said again, this is a topic that needs a lot of time, and I hope that we can have more of these broadcasts, that we can speak about them. So thank you very much for your input. And we will, I want to bring on Amer Zahar to speak, and then we'll bring everyone in to have an open dialogue for whatever time left in the program. Amer, thank you for joining me.
Hi, Wissam Kifa.
Amer, you wrote on Arab Mother's Day, "We lose the Arab mother to us all." Mm-hmm. Rest in peace, Nawal Saadawi. Allah yarhamek. You got about 2,000 comments. There is 1,100 likes. You got 213 love. You got 83 caring. You got 66 angry.
Oh, that's it.
16 shocked.
Oh.
And 414 laughed. Oh, while 393 cried. So about 75% of your audience actually in agreement with you. But you had interesting comments, and if you, your audience is very wide, and Amer Zahar is a professor of law at Detroit Mercy and a community activist, Palestinian rights activist, and a comedian, one of the Arab American voices in America. I consider him one of the most important voices. And you have a wide audience, very representative of Arab American community in the United States, because everyone likes comedy and everyone likes you. So your the comments on your posts are very telling. And Zainab Asaf, she spoke about that, about sometimes the conversation is really a lot lower than what Nawal Saadawi was about. What's your take on that?
Yeah, well, again, thanks, Wissam, for putting this together, and thanks for having me with the wonderful panelists that you've had so far, which I don't measure up to. But look, social media always fosters a conversation that is not, well, let's just say a bit more superficial than we would like. That's number one. But number two, you know, what I saw was an oversimplification of Nawal Saadawi and her views. And, you know, oversimplifications are not, you know, an oversimplification can be, you know, oversimplified but accurate, you know, but in this case, they were oversimplified but an inaccurate, you know. It's easy to oversimplify her. You know, you have to read her work to understand that she was coming from a position of love for the Arab culture. A position of love and someone who wants to see the Arab culture and the Arab world in a better place. And that's why when I saw people reducing her to an Islamophobe or an atheist, or, you know, not that atheist is generally necessarily bad or anything, but she actually rejected those terms. I mean, we have quotes from Nawal Saadawi, and she didn't like labels, you know, generally, like most intellectuals don't. And when she was asked if she was an atheist, she said, you know, in order to be an atheist, you have to refuse religion. And she said, I'm not an atheist because I'm outside of religion. I don't believe in it or not believe in it, but I see it as a social phenomenon. Okay. And she studies it in that way, just like any other ideology. Now, you might not like that, but that's not the mark of an atheist, right? An atheist is someone who very loudly and proudly says there is no God. Nawal Saadawi was not that simple, you know, and it wasn't that simple. You know, I go back to the quote that Barbara Nimri Aziz brought up, that story where a reporter asks her, are you a good Muslim? And she says, that's between God and me. First of all, that's not something an atheist says normally, okay? And it's not something an Islamophobe says. You know, you have to understand Nawal Saadawi as a native. You know, the same words can mean different things coming from different people. So if an Arab commits a horrific act, you know, something that the media might call terrorism, although I hate that word, but if an Arab commits a horrific act and people are watching the news, and if there's a white guy from you know, the middle of nowhere America watching that, and he says, I hate Arabs. And if we, Sam, you're sitting and watching it with all your Arab friends, and you watch that and you say, I hate Arabs. Those mean two totally different things, right? And we all understand that those mean two totally different things because you're coming from different contexts and experiences and different motives. And Noel Sadawi was coming from that place in the latter example as someone who's a native of this culture who says, I want to see things be better. See, Islamophobes don't want the Muslim world to advance, right? They want the Muslim world to disappear, to disintegrate. Noel Sadawi is not an Islamophobe. Yes, she rejects political Islam. Yes, she sees the hijab as a tool of patriarchy. Yes, she wrote about these things deeply. Yes, she said very controversial things about the Quran and the holy texts. But you can't simply classify her as an Islamophobe, like many Muslims are doing that. This is the sort of reductionist thinking that, for lack of a better term, Western or American and European commenters engage in. We have to be very careful not to do that so as not to lose the real essence of who she was. For instance, on the hijab, and then I'll end here. For instance, on the hijab, she says, you know, so she's against the wearing of the hijab. She sees it as a tool of patriarchy. Okay, so she got to that conclusion. If you ask Noel Sadawi how she gets to that conclusion, it's pretty simple. She says, well, I read and studied Islam and the Quran very carefully. I read the Quran. The Quran doesn't say to me, it uses specific language about other things like covering your breasts, but it doesn't say cover your hair. So specifically to me, there is no Quranic requirement to cover your hair, although that could have been a Quranic requirement, but it wasn't. So since that requirement doesn't exist, and since the phenomenon of veiling does exist, then she finds a different reason as to why it exists. So she looks at patriarchy and tools of oppression and other things. Now, you can disagree with her as to why it exists, but that's not the way an Islamophobe would operate. In fact, an Islamophobe says Islam and the Quran require veiling. That's the first thing an Islamophobe says, okay? Because they don't understand. They don't read Arabic. They've never read the Quran. So they say the Quran requires veiling, and that's a symbol of the oppression of women, something inherent in Islam. No, Noel Sadawi said something different. She says very clearly, the oppression of women is not something that we must see as inherent in Islam. It's something that Islam as a civilization and maybe Arabs as a civilization have done and engaged in because patriarchy predates all this stuff, but not that it's inherently in the culture. That would inherently in the culture is the way an Orientalist or an Islamophobe would talk, and Noel Sadawi didn't talk like that. And so we have to be very clear about how we frame her when we're having these discussions after her death. And so, yes, as someone who's not that religious, and maybe Noel Sadawi didn't believe in God, I don't know. But yes, I do say Allah yirhama, because she was a major figure, a giant, not just for women, but for all Arabs in the last century.
Thank you, Amir. Thank you. Stay with us, please. I'm going to bring everyone in. Thank you very much, everyone, for your participation. I have a few questions for you before we leave. But if anyone has comments on what Amir has said, please go ahead before I ask my question. Jinan, do you have something? Any comments? You're muted.
No, I really loved what Amir said. Thank you for that.
Okay. The question is, I'm going to ask Jinan since the same order as we started. Do you find that what Noel Sadawi has fought for is going to become relevant at a futuristic time? Do you feel that she has the audience that she has been addressing? Is that audience has been improving, or is it something that's going to come up in the future?
That's a really good question, Wissam, and I'm glad you asked it. And I think that the nature of work, when you are a committed intellectual and activist, and as Amir said, when you are really committed to improving your community and loving your community, that I think you do the work. It's like being a parent a little bit, and you don't know how your work is going to impact people in the future, but you kind of are driven by a passion for justice and a kind of empathy for your community. So I think that, you know, I think that that was driving her. my own assessment is she will become increasingly important. Because I think if you think a little bit about how she talks about the intersection of how religion is used to prop up capitalism and patriarchy, in a sense, Noëlle Saadawi was avant la lettre, as they say, an intersectional feminist before that became. And as we look, for example, at what happened with the attack on the Asian women, as people are beginning to understand how the fetishization and the sexualization, for instance, of Asian women intersects with economics, that these are women who are doing sex work and they are very often exploited workers, and that they are very often the result of our imperialist wars, that I think that the kind of analysis and the insistence on looking at things in very specific ways, intersectionally, but within a global context, as Noëlle Saadawi never tired of reminding us, I think it's going to make her work increasingly important. And as I said in my little introduction, is that her recognition of anger. I already see younger Egyptian feminists, for example, there's a very interesting phenomenon now of women writing anonymously on blogs about the kind of sexual harassment that they are experiencing. And there's a kind of freedom in expressing the rage. So I think in reclaiming for women emotions as anger, my prediction is that her work will become increasingly important.
Thank you. Definitely, there is a movement of more outspoken feminists in the Middle East and the Arab world. Noëlle Saadawi, she took stances against social injustice and political injustice, and she opened many different fronts in front of her. Does that, in your meeting with her, Barbara, in New York, we have some also instances where she was giving lectures in various universities in the United States, and she would criticize some of the actions of the American government, or she would even fight for feminism within the United States. She didn't consider that necessarily women were at their best position in the West. Have you encountered personally with her that thought process? You're muted. Yeah, thank you.
Well, absolutely. I mean, her statements are so widely publicly available, and her writing. What I found difficult was how she was almost ostracized by, again, we're going back to the 90s and even the early 2000s, for a long time ostracized by her own people here, Arab communities who needed a heroine, who needed good spokespeople, who needed daring people willing to handle the American Western media. And I feel badly that she was outside of most of our community. And she was championed, on the other hand, by the Western feminists who she criticized. So it's a very difficult role for a leader to play. And I do hope, that, as Janann suggests, that and the others, that she will be examined more carefully, especially since she has given us so many books. She'll be examined and thought about more extensively by all Arab women, whether we're here or we're living in the homelands. That's all I'll say right now. I mean, you've opened up a dialogue, Wissam, and thanks very much for that. We could go on for much longer, I know. Thank you.
You're welcome. Zainab is with us. Zainab, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you, Issam.
Yeah, unfortunately, we can't see you, but at least we can hear you. Yeah. Zainab, I'm worried about something. Some of them Arab feminists and in the Arab awakening, in the Arab Renaissance, in the early 20th century and late 19th century, there were some outspoken Arab women. Al Fatat wa Sheikh, the book that was written also about hijab at that time, things that are sometimes you think that's very advanced to be written in the 1920s. I was hoping that these would have time where they would come back to life and would play more a role in our society, but we haven't seen that. We haven't seen the Renaissance writers like Qasim Amin and others. We haven't seen their literature come back to life. Do you think that that they will at a certain point? And will Nawal Istadawi end up forgotten like the also writers of the Renaissance in the future?
You know what, Wissam, that's a very important question, actually. And then when we say our culture, we have to ask ourselves what kind of culture we are teaching. I mean, how about if we teach, instead of teaching all these very specific shuyukh of Islam who were like very tight in their understanding, how about if we teach, for example, Ibn Arabi and Ibn Rushd and all these people, like our whole perspective, our whole understanding will be really shifting to a completely different place. I mean, when we think about like, when we are studying European history, for example, it's mainly the Renaissance. It's mainly all these people who changed humanity. But what we did is we marginalized them in our culture. These people are not anywhere. You have to really go and look for them instead of like being in our schools, instead of teaching them. We teach the versions which are not... They don't work anymore. Like these are kind of like frozen in time and we are still there. So I feel like it's not only about feminism, Wissam. The problem is much bigger than that. The problem is about what kind of ideas we are producing today. Are we at least at the level of the Abbasi time, for example, which is like people were talking about Khalq al-Quran, for example, you know? So the even nature of Quran. So these kind of questions, we cannot even think about asking them today in the 21st century. And that can tell us like even just the hijab is not something very principal in our Al-Aqidah and Sharia, and I think Nawal talked about this too. So it's not something very principal. But now even talking about this, which is like a really the detail of the detail, became a taboo. We cannot even discuss it. Like once you open your mouth and you say that, and you know what? Even my own students, they do attack me when I talk this way because like, no, this is something they take it very personal. But listen, no, we're having discussion about like this is something not very important. The discussion that were happening in the third Hijri century are much more advanced than the discussions we're having today. And this is really sad, actually. I mean, I don't know, is it gonna change in the future? So that's why Nawal Istadawi is a very important figure. We still need a lot of Nawal Istadawi. We still need a lot of martyrs who are ready to be slaughtered all the time during their life and their death until we really get to this point, which is like we see ourselves in a mirror, because it's very easy to keep attacking others, you know, like we are the victims. This is what others did to us. But once we start seeing ourselves in a mirror, this is when the whole narrative changed. And when I say that, I say everyone, not only men or women, the whole culture, you know. Because we know like today, like, and it's really sad, and a lot of people were talking about that, that women who are attacking Nawal Istadawi are much more than men. And I'm not very surprised, because women are the gatekeepers of the culture. So they feel like they have to defend their choices, and they feel that Nawal is somehow an example that cannot it doesn't follow the stereotype, and this is really hard for them. They cannot accept it. So I think, yeah, I think we still have a long way to go with them.
Yeah, thank you, Zainab. Yeah, definitely we have a long way to go. Wafa, a final question for you. There is not a person more than Nawal al-Saadawi going all out, speaking her mind as it is. I don't think there's any reservations that she has kept. She's remained fierce as her brand from first day to the last interview she had. Do you feel that this emboldens activists that, you know, okay, well, she died in Egypt and she, you know, lived her life. She went through all these struggles and all these attacks and lawsuits. She made her way through. I think she came out victorious. Do you think this emboldens and strengthens freedom of speech and activists?
Well, quite. Thank you so much for the question. I think that's the effect of all this is quite the opposite. We need a shocking method as far as feminist goes, and as far as taking the risk. And I think part of what made Nawal al-Saadawi unique is this honesty and straightforwardness in her discourse and narratives. And after all, I mean, that's why she's called, I mean, a danger writer or a danger author. We need more danger minds and danger authors and danger feminists. And like Munat Tahawi and Jinan spoke about angry feminists who would not shy away from using the direct method and naming the spade a spade and facing the patriarchy and its the sources that reinforce patriarchy, whether religious or political, directly. I think what's lacking, actually, and the reason why we're lagging right now is because we're still shy as women or as feminists because of the cultural oppression, the political oppression put on us. But the more bold we come out, the more straightforward, the more we use Nawal al-Saadawi's approach, the more, I mean, we transition the feminist narrative as far as the North Africa and the Middle East is concerned. I think that part of the reasons, and I might be wrong, but this is my reading, part of the reasons why women's status in Tunisia, for instance, in comparison to other countries in the region, it is slightly better, is because of these outspoken and bold feminist voices who, yes, they're undergoing a lot of threats, they're facing a lot of struggles, some of them even jailed, went to jail, but they created, they made the change. And nowadays, I mean, if you see the younger generations, the young feminists, I mean, they are on fire. And nowadays, because of the feminist and the intersectionalist approach that they understood, even though, like, I personally have some issues with intersectionalism, but because of this intersectionalist approach that was pioneered by Nawal al-Saadawi, I mean, these young feminists, these young women, nowadays, for instance, in a nation like Tunisia, we don't only speak about a class and the feminism has to have, and women have to have rights. We're speaking about rights of LGBTQ, and they're bold, they're in the street. LGBT people are in the street in Tunisia. We're speaking about the rights of the natives, of the Amazigh women and Amazigh men, and it's a bold discourse. And this all comes out to how to this direct and straightforward and the shocking method that Nawal al-Saadawi used in her discourse. And I think, I mean, the results are quite the opposite. If we all come together outspokenly, I think we're going to change a lot.
Thank you, Wafa. And with that, we come to an end of our program, unless someone wants to say any final words before I end. Thank you very much. I want to thank my guests and everyone who watched this program. It will be available immediately after the end of the show at the YouTube and Facebook pages of Muslimish. And it will be available shortly on Muslimish Freethinkers podcast and Dearborn blog podcast. Thank you very much. May Nawal al-Saadawi rest in peace, and may all activists have her strength and her fierce energy to fight for human rights and for women's rights. Have a great rest of your week.
Thanks very much for organizing this. It was a very nice program.
Thank you, Baba. Thank you, Jinan, and thank you, Wafa. Thank you, Zainab, and thank you, Amr Zahr, who had to go for another show.
Thank you for listening to Muslimish Freethinkers. Do let us know what you think of this episode at facebook.com/Muslimish. Don't forget to visit us at muslimish.org.